Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
And here we go. Reggie okay in the booth? Yes. Thumbs up. Level's good. Yep. Talent ready. I'm psyched today. I'm always psyched, but I'm a little extra psyched. This one's kind of going to be a little fun, so let's get right to it, right? All right. Star, smile, strong. We love those three S's, so let's do it. Three, two, one. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted for your podcasting pleasure. If you want to hear more of this, you can go to my landing page, which is found at WGNplus.com in the entertainment section. You just go to the Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic prompt, where you will find all previous 168 episodes, which can only mean one thing. This is episode 169er, and Niner plays a part, because later in this podcast, we will talk to Emily Arminetti about the new Beverly Hills 90210 reunion that just started in the Pop Culture Club. And for those fans of that show is known as The Niner. So a little nostalgia, and I figured we would do a little nostalgia theme for this episode this week. And so not only will we be talking about Beverly Hills 90210, both the show's past as well as now its present in a reunion show that has brought back all of the original characters except for Luke Perry, who sadly passed away about a year or so ago. But we will talk about that in the Pop Culture Club. But I want to talk about today, because just this past week, only a few days ago, in fact, was the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. And there's been a lot of controversy. There's been a lot of memories as well as confusion. And as I said, some controversy swirling around Woodstock as it celebrated its 50th anniversary. The actual anniversary was August 15th through the 17th, when the infamous and famous Woodstock Music Festival took place in upstate New York, in Bethel, New York, on a, I believe, a, I can't, 600 acre farm. And it turned out to not just be an important music festival, it turned out to be a very important generational moment and sociological and cultural moment in this country. Probably most unexpected, too. It was initially going to be some cool music festival in upstate New York. Those were the fairly ambitious goals, to put on a cool music festival in upstate New York, coming off the popularity of some other music fests that had happened in the mid to late 60s, most significantly the Monterey Pop Festival, which took place on the West Coast. The idea was, well, let's do something on the East Coast. So in August 15th through the 17th, 1969, a crazy idea turned into something that is still a flashpoint in terms of the baby boom generation, the 60s decade, which is defined by both hope as well as turbulence. And really, as once again, also a music festival, which featured some of the legendary acts of the day in the late 60s. You've probably heard a lot about Woodstock, and I don't have to go through all of the history of it, but it is important to put it in perspective. But what really sort of turned my eye was something that I came upon by accident. I had forgotten I even had done this. But I started my media career, if you will, when I was still in college. I started to write for a newspaper group in the Chicago area suburbs, and I had a weekly music column for the Press Publication newspapers, which was out in the western suburbs. And they had about, 10 or 15 papers throughout all the western suburbs. It was based in Elmhurst, Illinois. And I did a weekly column called Roxy. In fact, if you listen to me with any kind of regularity, if you listen to this podcast, the early podcast, or if you listen to me on the radio, I often talk to Mick Kaler. And Mick Kaler started this column in the early 80s and did it for a couple of years. And then he stopped writing it and he suggested me to his editors. And so I was his successor when he left it. So Mick and I go way back. We met on our college radio station at Elmhurst College, soon to be Elmhurst University, apparently, at the radio station there at the college. Good old WRSE 88.7 FM. And it has had some very prominent alumni. Probably the most prominent is Chicago Radio's very own, I should say, Terry Hemmert, who went to Elmhurst College and was on the air at WRSE. But anyway, so I wrote this rock scene column for about 4 or 5 years, and I was looking for a certain thing that I had written, and so I was going through one of my infamous bins where I have all my writing. when they open the museum, it will all be there for the public to read. And as I was looking for something else, I came upon this story with the headline that says Woodstock 20, Young Enough to Be Trusted. And I was writing about Woodstock on its 20th anniversary in 1989, when I was still a young buck in my mid-20s. And I was like, wow, how funny, this whole Woodstock 50th anniversary is happening right now, and I find this column that I wrote when Woodstock was 20. And so I read it, and I was, it was almost like looking at an old photo of yourself, only I was reading the words of that I wrote 30 years ago instead of looking at what I looked like 30 years ago. And it was so interesting because as I read it, I was like, wow, I would think the same. I think this column holds up in terms of what it talked about. And it also seems a little prophetic as to what I predicted. But it also was interesting to read about what I was thinking and how I was thinking at that time in my life about Woodstock and about the bigger issues of rock music and the culture. And I would have to say that there was a little innocence there, but Also, I think there was a little maturity, because as I read this 30 years later, I think I would be, I have said the same thing about Woodstock that I said here. So I'm going to read this to you a little later here. It's not all that long. And you can get a sense of what I was thinking of at the time. And also, again, remember of what was going on. This was 1989. Woodstock was only 20. And here we are now in 2019, and Woodstock is 50. And as I said, it's really been an interesting controversy. Back in January, they wanted to do another Woodstock. They did a 30th anniversary in 1999, which was somewhat successful, sadly, until the last day when the Woodstock Festival in 1999 took a very dark and violent turn. In the last day and night of the event became very violent, and things were started on fire, and there were basically riots, and it really turned into a the exact opposite of what the idea of Woodstock was all about, which was peace and music. You know, the logo, the image of the Woodstock event, the Woodstock Music Festival, was a white dove. Don't forget, Woodstock was being held right in the middle of the Vietnam War, where tensions were high and the student protests were very, very both violent as well as angry and enthusiastic. And the country was torn in 1969. And here was this concert that no one expected to become such a flashpoint in American history. But what it did prove, more than the music, and there were some great musical acts and performances at Woodstock, like Jimi Hendrix and The Who. There were some other bands, but Janis Joplin played there. A lot of people said that her performance wasn't all that great. Some of them were good, some of them weren't. Santana was certainly one that people talked about. Crosby, Stills, and Nash made their debut at Woodstock. So it certainly was notable for the acts that played of the day, but it didn't have the Beatles. The Doors were not there. The Stones were not there. So some of the bigger acts of the day were also not a part of Woodstock. But what really made everybody's head turn was what they expected, perhaps 25,000, turned into, most estimates put it at between 400,000 and 500,000 people, literally came from around the country and in many cases around the world to converge. And it was really the first moment when the younger generation of the day that was beginning to flex its muscles politically and socially and culturally without really knowing it made itself heard and known. It was very organic. People just read about it in music newspapers, or they heard about it, and they were just drawn to come because they felt that this was something that was speaking to them, this festival in New York with these amazing acts, and it was going to be kind of a cool thing to go to. No one really thought that maybe 500,000 young people would come from all over the place, stop traffic, and basically create their own city for a couple of days, and yet, unlike the 30th anniversary in 1999, in the midst of the hippie generation, the drug culture, the protests of Vietnam, there were no incidents. There were no murders. There was no violence. For that weekend, at least, the goal, the ambition, the vision of the hippie generation, the hippie manifesto of peace and love and music, whatever you want to call it, really did happen for those 2 days. And because it was so pristine, because it was so organic, there has always been a hope or a movement whenever a special anniversary of Woodstock comes up to recreate that. But Woodstock happened by accident, and you can't create an accident. And so while promoters and the original promoters have tried to put on, you know, other Woodstocks and create that sense, it just has never happened. It didn't really happen in 1999 because it ended in a very violent and dark way, the exact opposite of what the original Woodstock stood for. And here, 50 years later, the concert couldn't even get off the ground. In January, there were big plans, and the idea was to meld the past with the present, and so have some of the groups that performed at the original Woodstock, including John Fogerty, who was a part of Creedence Clearwater Revival, who played there 50 years ago, as well as having some of today's bigger stars, like Miley Cyrus and Jay-Z, were also rumored to be playing at the new Woodstock 50, which was going to hopefully be held somewhere in the vicinity of the original one up in near Bethel, New York, and upstate New York. But for some reason, as soon as it was announced, it seemed as if this project just was riddled with problems. There were permit problems, and it was never really fully explained as to why this event couldn't get off the ground. They were talking about permits. I would think that if you're putting on a concert like this is common. You know, back in 1969, putting on a concert like this was not commonplace. But 50 years later, you know, putting on concerts in and outdoor concerts anywhere, there's a formula to it. And for some reason, this one just was plagued. And maybe it's because after 50 years, it's just not that ideal anymore. And maybe we think differently now. And maybe that idea of what Woodstock was 50 years ago is just that. It's what it was 50 years ago. And sadly, maybe, you know, we learned a lesson here that you can't go back and recreate history. We always try to. And we try with television shows and with music in terms of, you know, reunion concerts or sequels to movies or reboots to television shows. And we try, and sometimes they work better than others. But Woodstock was really something, as I said, that no one expected. It was meant to be a 2 or 3 day kind of hippie event with some, you know, music there, it's a craft show, and, you know, it is what it is. It certainly was going to be big within the young culture and the hippie generation, but certainly wasn't going to make any kind of a dent in the mainstream. But it sent a very important signal that the young generation did have the ability to come together. And they did have the ability to shift ideas. When 500,000 kids, probably from the age of 14 to 20 or so, 22, 23, found their way and went to Woodstock and sat there in the mud and in the rain all night, camped out, very little food, you know, primitive, you know, conditions to say the least, but they stayed there. There were no violent incidents, and they came out in force, and they showed the establishment in this country that they were a voice that they better begin to recognize. And after Woodstock, the baby boomer generation began to really flex its muscles as a group that needed to be reckoned with. And even though the Vietnam War didn't stop until almost 5 or 6 years later completely in 1975, certainly the pressure that the baby boomers and those young college students and those young people at the time kept putting on the government and the protests, there's no doubt that Richard Nixon heard those protests, and it did influence his decisions. And Woodstock played a role in that. Woodstock made the government. Woodstock made parents. Woodstock made the entertainment world. Woodstock made our entire culture turn around and go, whoa, what was that? And what does that mean? And so for those 2 days, it was exactly what it was supposed to be. A festival of music and peace and love. 50 years later, it stands as a coming of age of a generation. And now 50 years later, that generation is now in its 60s and 70s and has had to cede and give away a lot of its power to a new generation, the millennials. And so there is a push and pull, because the baby boomers are huge in number and they're not ready to go away. And so that's why there's a big division in this country. A lot of people think it's just based on race or it's based on political ideology. But I believe that the divisiveness we have in this country is because we've got a huge baby boomer population that has always played a role, that have always had power. They're from their teens. They exerted their power. They rebelled against the establishment, and our culture has moved with them in the last 50 years. And so they're not ready to give up, even though the millennial generation is doing what it can to put its views on the culture. And so I think more than racial, more than political, more than ideological, we've got a cultural thing of generations. It's an interesting generation because it's not so much a generation gap. The baby boomers understand the millennials to some extent because they raised them. You know, who raised the millennials? The baby boomers, for the most part. So they understand them. They're responsible for them. But they are also used to having the spotlight, and they're not going to give it up until they go away. So I think that's where we're at right now to a great extent as well. But I thought it would be fun to read my article that I wrote 30 years ago about Woodstock and give a listen and see if 30 years ago what I sort of talk about here hasn't come true to some extent. And you'll see some references of the day. Don't forget, this was written in 1989. So remember the perspective of the time this was written in. And I was in my mid-20s as well. I don't know if I was necessarily a cockeyed optimist, which pretty much is the deal 30 years later. But give a listen and see what you think. The title is Woodstock 20, Young Enough to be Trusted. Woodstock, period. By now, you've probably watched and read countless accounts commemorating the 20th anniversary of that mudslide of a musical event, the Woodstock Music and Art Fair, held August 15th through the 17th near Bethel, New York. Most of these memorable moments have been related by the musical artists who performed at the festival, journalists who covered it, people who attended the event, and just plain folks who lived nearby. and couldn't believe the birth of a nation that took place on that farm. I suppose getting reactions from the about the event from these types of people is important to get a feeling for what it was like to be there, although if anyone who claims to have been actually there was, they probably would have had to elect their own president, and put the event in its proper historical perspective. However, now that Woodstock has become more of a cultural icon rather than just a concert, it seems its significance and importance has grown with each passing year. Woodstock is a symbol more than anything else. The only problem is defining that symbol. The music festival unwittingly became a rally for the counterculture, an event that unified the hippies, the yippies, the flower children, the rockers, and any other group whose members were under the age of 30. Remember, anyone older than that couldn't be trusted back then. Many children of the 60s are backpedaling now, trying to show they haven't sold out to the establishment values that they once rebelled against so strongly 20 years ago. But many of their rationalizations have lost their strength when the declaration comes from a house in the suburbs with 2.4 children sitting on their knees. Many Woodstockers are now stock brokers, and most have settled into their traditional careers. Though there's nothing wrong with that, many flower children feel the guilt of or betrayal. But I say, hey, don't worry about it. We all have to make a living. Everyone remotely associated with Woodstock has been interviewed, but in their effort to relive the event, the media forgot a very important group that I'd like to address. The next generation. The Pepsi generation, if you will. It's great reading about what it was like to be one of the thousands of vagabonds sleeping in the mud, having no toilets, no money, and no showers, but enjoying incredible music by rock giants like Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Santana, The Band, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Joe Cocker, and a host of others. But if you want to find out what Woodstock was about, let's ask someone who wasn't there, but feels its effects, if any, 20 years later. No, I didn't hitchhike 400 miles to get there. I didn't take baths in a dirty river. I didn't father a child there. And I didn't eat any psychedelic mushrooms. I, in fact, was 5.5 years old in August of 1969. My only real memory of Woodstock is probably still sucking on my thumb. But here it is. Recollections of Woodstock from someone not associated with it at all. Well, maybe I should qualify that. One of the few people who doesn't claim to have been there. For me, Woodstock does have some significance. It was a first example of the real unifying force of rock and roll. Before Woodstock, rock was still viewed by many as a passing fad that would soon fade away. But when all those people, in attendance records vary from 500,000 to 1 billion, depending on who you talk to, when all those people converged on that 600-acre farm to hear and see rock and roll, it sent a message to the world that this sort of music was something to be reckoned with. It seems the legends are better than the actual performances. Hendrix's classic searing rendition of the Star Spangled Banner is probably the most lasting musical memory. And many feel The Who established themselves with their Woodstock performance. But many other groups, such as The Band and The Grateful Dead and others, don't speak very highly of their performances. But the quality of the music wasn't as important as the fact that the music was being played. It was rock and roll. It was their music. 20 years later, my generation has faint memories of most of the performers of Woodstock. Of course, Hendrix and Janis Joplin are easily recognizable, but that's most likely due to their untimely deaths. John Sebastian of the Loving Spoonful is known but more for his Welcome Back Cotter theme from the 70s than anything else. Santana has continued to rock, but more people my age know Winning than Black Magic Woman. Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young haven't sung in tune for 20 years now. And Jefferson Airplane became a starship as I grew up. Culturally, I guess we all wish we had a Woodstock. Every generation has looked for its own Beatles or Woodstock, but we've come up short. You can't manufacture phenomenons. They just happen. Elvis just happened. The Beatles just happened. Woodstock just happened. We've tried. We tried with Bowie. We tried with Elton. We tried with the Bee Gees. We tried with Michael Jackson. We tried with Prince. The closest we've come is probably Bruce Springsteen, but even he has soured to some now. We tried with Live Aid. We tried with Farm Aid. We tried with every aid in between. Rock and roll means freedom and community, and we've tried to show the older generation that we're carrying on that tradition. History will always defeat our attempts to have our own Woodstock because it will always be compared to the original. And it can never really live up to it, whatever it was. Before Woodstock, there wasn't another event with which to compare it to. It became important because it was the first. For me, Woodstock was a muddy, disorganized, idealistic triumph. It's something for my generation to strive for, though. But I really doubt if we'll ever get there. We're not star children. We just want our MTV. And that's the column I wrote when I was 25 years old, celebrating the 20th anniversary of Woodstock and looking at it from a 25-year-old's perspective, somebody that is looking back and at this cultural event and wondering what it means to me and what it may mean in the future. And as we've seen, I think I was a little prophetic there. We have never been able to recreate Woodstock, even though we tried. We tried in 1999 and it failed. And we tried in 2019 and it didn't even get off the ground. Woodstock was a moment in time. It was an ideal. It remains an ideal. It remains, as I said in that column, a phenomenon, but you can't recreate something that just happened. But as I look back at this, I say at this column that I wrote, I think that I had a fairly good perspective on things back in 1989 as to what Woodstock was and what it might be in the future. And here we are celebrating its 50th anniversary, and it kind of came and went without much fanfare. More disappointment than celebration. That says a lot about where we're at right now, doesn't it? And welcome back to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. And now we will take a stroll over to the Pop Culture Club with pop culture guru Emily Arminetti. And so let me just say, hello, Emily. How you doing?
Hey, Jim. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Doing fine. This is really in your wheelhouse.
It's been a good week for me,
I would say. The first part of the podcast, I was talking about Woodstock and the fact that by chance, I found an article, a column, when I was a music columnist, that I wrote 30 years ago about Woodstock when it had turned 20. And how I was, writing it from the mind and the eyes of a 25-year-old, and how interesting it was to read what I wrote then and to see how a few things changed, but really, I think it still holds up. And so it's interesting. I figured, well, if we're going to talk about nostalgia, then we might as well talk about probably one of the bigger nostalgia things to hit TV in a long time. And, of course, that is the return of a show that I would assume, and you've said on many occasions, but had to have been the show that you would most associate with your growing up years, right?
Oh, yes, 100%.
100%.
And would probably most want to have a reboot of. So this
really?
Is like a gift from
you actually not only would say that Beverly Hills 90210 was your favorite show of all time, but you actually were hoping for a reboot.
Well, I mean, everything's getting a reboot these days, so why not The Niner? The Niner, as you know, we can just refer to it from here on out as The Niner.
And we should say, though, I think this is more of a reunion because it's not a reboot. It's not being redone with different people. These are the original characters, at least as most as are available.
Well, right. That's right. Exactly. It's not a reboot in the sense that they are taking the premise, getting a whole new cast, and then like remaking it, but with a new generation. So it's not like that, but it's also different. So it's also not like, let's say, Will and Grace, where they've got the same cast of characters and they're just picking up, you know, 10, 20 years later. What they've done with this reboot is totally different, I think, than any that I can think of. And as you know, there is a lot of nostalgia lately in the reboot and the remake, and that's all very big right now. But so what they're doing in this is they've brought back the original cast members, but they're playing heightened fictionalized versions of themselves. You see what I mean? The actors.
Oh, so they're not really playing their characters.
But they are. So they're doing both. So basically, let me just get you orientated, because I mean, I'm a little shocked that you didn't watch it, but I'm guessing you didn't watch it.
Well, considering that I never watched the original, I didn't really have much of an interest in the reunion.
Well, I wrote a book about the original, and so that gives you an idea of, you know, if you didn't believe me that this was probably, for me, one of the most impactful pop culture touchstones of my, you know, especially in my coming of age years, you know.
I don't know if that's sad or not.
I literally wrote a book about it. But anyway.
I don't know if that's sad or if that's admirable.
I know. I agree with you. I don't know either. I don't know either. So that, yeah, jury's still out on that. But, you know, but I have to be true to myself, speaking from the heart. No, I love this show and I'm very glad it's back. And so basically what they're doing is they're playing versions of themselves, but we'll call it a pilot episode if you can, pilot for the reboot. The premise is that the actors who played the main characters on the show, so that's Jason Priestley, Jenny Garth, you know, Ian Ziering, Gabrielle Carteris, Brian Austin Green, Tori Spelling, and Shannon Doherty, of course, we're missing Luke Perry. May he rest in peace. We can get on to that in
right.
a minute. But the premise is they come together for like a weekend, like a fan convention for fans of Beverly Hills 90210,
right.
A convention in Las Vegas. And while they are there, you know, they sort of reconnect as a group, for better or worse. You know, of course, like I said, they're playing fictionalized heightened versions of themselves. So there are some good feelings, there are bad feelings, there's everything in between, there hijinks ensue. And in the end of that first episode, I don't think I'm giving anything away here because I think it's probably important to know this, that this is what the rest of the series is based on. They end up deciding to reboot the series. So over the course of the next, I think there are going to be 6 episodes. So over the course of the next 5 episodes, apparently what we will be seeing is the actors playing themselves, but then there will be that we will see them filming scenes of this reboot where they're playing the characters.
So it'll be a show within. So it'll be a show within the show.
Yes. And so we'll get to see, you know, Shannon Doherty playing herself, which will be interesting because she had quite a reputation, you know, right. even back then on the show, her playing herself, but then also playing the character of Brenda Walsh for the reboot.
Now, so, you know, explain to me and maybe other people that don't get it. You said that how impactful this show was, and you were kind of laughing about it. But explain to me really what was the phenomenon of 90210 at the time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
why do you is it pure nostalgia now, or is there really a legitimate reason aside from just seeing these people together again on a TV show, a reason to do this? But first, start with the first one. So,
okay.
I would assume that you were a late teen, early 20s when the show.
No, I was a teenager, so yeah. I don't know how I would have been. I don't know if I had been in my early 20s when the show started. I'm not sure if I would have been as attached, but the show started, it originally aired in 1990, okay? So I was in high school. I was basically the same age as some of the characters on the show.
Right.
And I think that's a big thing with my generation, too. If you were in high school or about to go in high school at that time, maybe even early college years, you could really relate to this. But I think what Beverly Hills 90210 did and why it had an impact on that demographic of people is that, you know, they had this show where they're in a very glamorous place, right? They're in Beverly Hills. It was about a group of teens who are growing up, you know, many of them in kind of wealthy situations, but not all of them. And then you had these twins who move, you know, played by Shannon Doherty and Jason Priestley, move from Minnesota and are transplanted into Beverly Hills. And so now you're also seeing this. So you're seeing this more glamorous life than maybe a lot of us know. But then you're seeing it through the eyes of people who are kind of living it, but very new to it. But what was really impactful, I think, about it is they're going through all the, you know, they're going through their teenage years. And so there are a lot of issues that they dealt with on that show throughout the course of the show. And I think it ran for like 10 seasons, maybe. But the thing that I think spoke to people, young people, the most is that they dealt with topics that were relevant to young people in a way that was not patronizing, you know. So they dealt with like drugs and drinking and driving and teen pregnancy and, you know, sexual assault and things like that in a way that teenagers didn't feel like they were being patronized, but also it was somewhat realistic, but yet they still had this overall wholesome feel to the show. So no topic ever really got so massively controversial that it was hard, that it was just too much to deal with. So I think for those reasons, it really spoke to people.
But was it like soap opera-y, like, say, at the same time, the adult version, if you would, was, say, Melrose Place?
I would say that Melrose, well, and did Aaron Spelling produce both of those? I can't remember. I remember they were back to back.
I think did. Yeah, I think he may have.
But I think Melrose Place was also a little too soap opera-y. You know, it was a little too melodramatic. It was a little too whatever. There was something also nice about how wholesome Beverly Hills 90210 felt that I think all these decades later, the reason why their core audience is so excited about this reboot is like, it just, you left it with an overall good feeling. I don't know if you could say that the same thing about Melrose Place, but.
So yeah. So now, like I said, as when we're talking, there's only been one episode. But most of the actors. Get to part two then. So now, you know, how many years has the show been off? It's been over, you know, almost 20 years, probably, right? That the show's been off. Because most of the stars are in their late 40s or early 50s, right? I think Luke Perry was certainly, I think he was 51 or 52.
Yes, he was. And actually, some of them were even older. I mean, Gabrielle Carteris was, I want to say, in her early 30s playing a high schooler back then.
Was she really?
This is the great thing about the reboot. So that was always kind of a joke even then. Like, when people sort of realized right. how much older she was in real life
right.
than her actual character. And now the funny thing is, so that with the reboot, the way they're doing it is, you know, it's kind of humorous. It's meta, very self-referential. You know, they're definitely playing on a lot of those, like, you know, things that either, you know, kind of inside jokes of, you know, about the actual original show itself, but then also kind of like some of the, you know, the thing, some of the perceptions about the real life actors and how they've come across over time in the news or the tabloids. So, for example, the big joke back then was that when people discovered how old, you know, Gabrielle right. Carteris was in comparison to her character that she was playing. Well, right off the bat, in the first 5 minutes of this reboot, you find out she's a grandmother. Okay. So, you know, it's like, wink, wink, grandma.
Right.
And then, I mean, just, you know, and they have all kinds of other, like the Tory spelling. I'm sure anyone who's read anything about her in recent years has read that, you know, there have been rumors that she's in financial trouble. And of course, we all know she grew up in, you know, Aaron Spelling was her father. She grew up in like the biggest house in Beverly, you know, yeah. Beverly Hills, possibly even in America.
Right.
You know, no shortage of money there. I mean, they have millions of dollars. Her mother, her father has passed away in real life. Her mother inherited that whole fortune, but gives her apparently little to no financial support. And so, and that is a real thing. I mean, we've seen Tori Spelling in recent years on reality shows about her own life, and she has made it clear that she hustles and she struggles to like make a paycheck. And that's very much, they've made that very much a part of her storyline, only again, this is all heightened versions. So they blow it even more out of proportion than it might even be in real life, if you see what I mean. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting what they're doing with it because it's clever, it's funny, it's tongue in cheek, it's dark at times. Like the first episode, I would say, had some dark moments, you know, and I'm not just because they have addressed the Luke Perry's passing, and they did that in the first episode in a really touching way. I mean, I had the lump in my throat and the, you know, instant lump that felt like someone kicked me in the gut, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a really clever way of handling this.
I'm surprised that for given the popularity of the show and given the fact that you know, they've got most, if not all, you know, aside from, you know, Luke Perry, obviously, mm-hmm. the entire, you know, cast pack or everything. I'm surprised that they, you know, launched it in the middle of summer here, you know?
Well, no, let me tell you something about that. And that might actually be the most genius move ever. And they've done well in the ratings. But so I'm sure you would not know this, and I'm sure not a lot of people, even really hardcore fans of the original show, would know this. But when it originally aired back in 1990, it did not do well in the ratings. But then what they did was when they aired the next season, they actually started airing it in the summer when all of the other shows were on hiatus and it right. was nothing but reruns on TV. And that is when it actually became a huge hit in the ratings. So it might be kind of genius that they've kicked this off in the summertime. I mean, I know we live in a different world now where there's streaming and there's, but there is a cycle of content, right? And summer isn't when you typically are going to see brand new content launching or posting or, you know,
yeah, that's, I mean, that's, so. I would have just thought that this would have been, I read that it was coming, and then all of a sudden I saw a commercial and they're like, you know, premieres, the, you know, tomorrow. And I was like, wow, like in the middle of August? I mean, these are the dog days of summer. Granted, yes, there's not a lot on, so they can, you know, there's not a lot of new stuff on. But as you said, we have a different world in terms of people's viewing habits and what they watch and when they watch it. But at the same time, I would think that just given the show's cachet and its history and its popularity, that they would have wanted to launch this as a major kind of, you know, fall thing mm-hmm. and make a big deal about it, as opposed to putting it on in a time when traditionally, you know, this is when people are either going on their final vacations right before school, you know what I mean? And so that was mm-hmm. kind of a strange, you know, regardless of when it caught on, like you said, that was a different time. And then, of course, there was a new season starting right after those reruns were shown. So it made a nice transition to, okay, I just watched the first season, and now I get to watch the new season, so now I'm really into it.
Right. But that's the thing, though, is that they're only doing this as a 6-episode thing.
Right.
So I think the question is going to be, if it continues to do really well in the ratings, does this mean You know, obviously, I don't think they'd be all, you know, they would be geared up to launch like in the fall. But, you know, who's to say that there's not going to be another, you know, season coming shortly thereafter, maybe in fitting more into the normal cycle of, you know, TV series rollouts.
So the important thing, I guess, aside from the concept and aside from the fact of the nostalgia aspect, I guess the one thing that we're all really interested in is, how do they all look?
Okay, I can tell you a lot of my friends loved this show. We used to watch it together. Even when we went away to college, we would have viewing parties in our rooms. So let me tell you, there's been a lot of texting back and forth about this and that in particular. But one of the first things that I texted out to people was, oh my gosh, Jenny Garth, who played the character of Kelly Taylor. Right. She was like one of the main characters on the show. She looks so amazing that whatever she is doing, she needs to bottle it, sell it, blog about it, launch a podcast, you know, parlay that into, I don't care, but we need to know. I need to know what she is doing because she looks phenomenal. I mean, I just think but in a way that you don't look at her and think, oh man, she is just full of Botox or full of fillers or whatever. And, right. You know, no judgment. I don't know. There's no judgment there, but it's like, sometimes when people look really great for their age, it's also obvious kind of how they're doing it. No, you cannot tell with her. You just look at her and you go, she just looks amazing. Better than she did back then.
Wow.
Ian Ziering looks great. Brian Austin Green looks amazing. I mean, he looks better now than he did back then. Like, whoever thought he would end up being, like, the hottest of the...
Right.
He played the nerd.
Right.
You might not remember this, but he played the nerd.
Oh, yeah, I remember, yeah.
But in real life, he's married to Megan Fox.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Which blew everybody's mind just because he played the nerd on that show.
Well, it's kind of amazing. And you can see why he's married to Megan Fox, because he's extremely, he's aged very well. And he's really grown up to be a very handsome man. Honestly, I mean, they all look good. You didn't get to see much of Shannon Doherty in the first episode because she comes in much late in the episode. And that's just part of the plot and the storyline. You know, Tori Spelling, I think she's had some work done, but I think even when
she had work done on the show.
Yeah, this is the thing. It's hard to say. And maybe, like, I would say, I mean, obviously, Gabrielle Carteris is the oldest on the show by miles, so she looks a lot older than they are, but she is a lot older than they are. So I would say on balance, everyone looks pretty good. despite the passage of time.
Right.
But yeah, for sure. I mean, honestly, like, I would say Jenny Garth and Brian Austin Green, they look better, even better than they did back then. So,
so at least from a diehard fan, this is so far so good then.
Yeah. And I have to say, going into it, I was nervous. I was like, this has to be good, because if this is not good, it is going to be really upsetting.
Well, if it wasn't good, would it have really, you know, damaged any of your feelings about the original show?
No, it wouldn't have changed my feelings about the original show, but I just think it would have been, you know, it's a fun thing to get excited about. And
do you watch the reruns?
It would have been disappointing. It would have been disappointing to say, well, I know that there are five more episodes coming on, but this was so terrible, I'm not even going to watch.
Do you ever watch the reruns of the old show?
I guess my question is, does it hold?
Do you think it holds up now?
Yeah.
Given your age and your experience, do you think that the show would still hold up if you went back and watched them?
I mean, if I'm thinking back, I wrote a book about this, so I do feel like I studied. I had way more attention on it than one person should, and I feel like it probably could still hold up. And not to say I haven't seen it since it stopped in 2000. I have watched it like at various points in time, like when I lived in London. I remember because, you know, at a certain point I got cable and I was able to watch other than like the five British channels that I had, and so occasionally a 90210 rerun would come on and I would watch it, and it was just nice. It felt like, you know, it was just a nice, fun, nostalgic thing to do. But yeah, no, I haven't. It's been a while since I've actually sat through an episode of the original. So I don't know. That could be a good experiment. Maybe I need to do that.
I mean, just from the standpoint of not only, you know, the content, but then, you know, once again, this is a show that, you know, in terms of the fashion and the look and the music and even the way the show is made, considering like the way the editing and the writing. I mean, you know, television has certainly changed. And a lot of times when you go back and watch some of these shows that you thought were so great, you go, you know, a lot of it is about the moment that they're in.
But again, like I said, they dealt with a lot of issues that young people really faced in real life. And I feel like that kind of thing doesn't change over time. I mean, yeah, today, in today's day and age, you know, teenagers have the additional layer of like social media and bullying and things like that. But, you know, for the most part, a lot of those same things that, you know, kids were dealing with when I was growing up, I mean, those are still things they're dealing with today. So from that perspective, now it might seem corny. Some of it might seem corny, but that's what is fun about the reboot too, is that again, it's very self-referential. It's very tongue in cheek. They know the original was kind of corny, and you see that, you see those wink, you know, you see the nods to that already, even just in the first episode.
I'm actually intrigued. I may try to watch one episode just to see because, like I said, I was never a big fan of Will and Grace, and yet, you know, I have watched that just to see. I watched enough episodes to know what the pace or what the gimmick of the show was. So, you know, when I watched the newer ones to see, okay, where are they at? You know, are they picking up? Do they still have the same, you know, kind of chemistry? And the same thing with Roseanne, you know, the same type of thing. So I enjoy, even if it was a show that I didn't necessarily like, I do go and watch what's really watched. But I do like to see the reboots or the remakes or the reunions just to get a sense of, okay, where is it? Is this going to be something that, you know, that can move on? And, you know, for instance, I knew right away, I watched the first episode, and I was not a huge fan of Murphy Brown. But I saw the first couple episodes and I said, this is dead in the water. It doesn't have it. Something's missing. And sure enough, very high profile. Murphy Brown won many Emmy Awards. You know, that character became very influential from the, you know, a feminist movement, even got embroiled in presidential politics thanks to Dan Quayle. So there was a lot going for that show in terms of bringing it back. And once again, when I watched the first couple episodes, I was like, okay, I'm done. I don't need to watch this anymore.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it was canceled.
I totally agree with you. And that was a bit, I mean, I didn't feel, look, I really liked the original Murphy Brown. You know, it's no Niner, but. Like,
well, few are.
But I was excited when it came back and then massively disappointed that it was.
Yeah. There was no energy to it. I thought it was very convoluted the way they were trying, and I felt it was very preachy. Whereas the original show certainly had a of point of view, but it wasn't as heavy handed. And I think that they really misjudged the thirst or the hunger of the masses for constant kind of Trump bashing, which basically was that show was. I think that's what killed it. The show was always political. It took place in Washington, and it poked fun at politicians. But it certainly had a Democratic and a liberal bent, because that's where she was. But this was so far off. I was like, wow, this it lost a lot of its cleverness, and it was just kind of regurgitating a lot of the vitriol and the rhetoric that was floating around. And I was like, no, that's not Murphy Brown.
Right.
You know? And
it just
so,
wasn't funny. And you're right. It was lacking the energy of the original series.
Now, I have to say, once again, now, when you watch 90210, you know, they're older. And do they still have that same energy? I mean, do they still feel? Does it still feel fresh, even though they're older?
Well, yes, but here, this is what I'm saying. I think the reason why it works is because they're coming at it from a different angle,
right? Instead of just rebooting, instead of just picking it up,
characters just 20 years later, right, and catching up to see, oh, you know, what are Brenda and Brandon up to at 46? You know, it's not like that. It's totally different, and I think that's why it works. It feels fresh, and it gives it a certain energy. And I think it's fun for the actors too. I mean, I saw Brian Austin Green being interviewed, and he said, you know, I think this is for me, the reason I was drawn to it is because it's not just revisiting a character I've already played. It's playing a character that's myself, but it's not me. You know, I'm playing the Brian Austin Green character, right, but then I do also get that
to play the other guy
dimension of playing David Silver 20 years later. So it's both. And I think for the actors, that's interesting. And the other thing that I thought was interesting, too, is that I think it works because they're all back in. Obviously, Luke Perry is not there. And they were already doing this when he passed away. And they kept him apprised. I've heard Jenny Garth and Tori Spelling, who actually were the ones who really championed this reboot thing and got it going. They said that he was always involved, though, in the discussions every step of the way. He was really supportive of what they were doing. And although he wasn't signed on to be part of the core cast, it sounds like there were probably going to be plans for him to come in certain guest star capacities or whatever. Right. So now I think the fact that they got them all back makes it work. But Shannon Doherty has said that the only reason she signed on to it was she sort of realized after Luke Perry passed away that this would be a nice way to honor his memory. So she was not on board.
Oh, that's interesting.
Until that happened.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So all in all, you would say so far from what you've seen of the reunion of the Niner gets a tenner.
The Niner gets a tenor. That's right. So far, so good. Fingers crossed for the next 5 episodes. I'm hoping it continues to be as good. And I'm also hoping they continue to do well in the ratings. And because they did get good ratings. And I'm hoping that it wasn't just a curiosity factor that bumped them up.
Right.
I'm hoping people will stick with it. Yeah. So,
well, very good. And I'm going to check an episode out, and I will get back to you and let you know what I think.
Okay. I am looking very forward to that.
Oh, very good. Well, once again, when I saw Beverly Hills 90210 was coming back, I knew we had to definitely talk to you about it, because this not only is in your wheelhouse, it is your wheelhouse.
It is. You're absolutely right.
Well, we will talk again soon, and I wish I should have had the song to play at the end.
But get a producer to dub it in. Yeah, because really, honestly, like I have not gotten sick.
What? Did we lose you?
That makes sense for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, take care. Have fun.
No, I'm still here. I was saying I.
Yeah. Oops.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Oh, you died again. What were you going to say? Say it real quick.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, in all the promotion that's been going on in the last few weeks, you know, the promotional stuff around the premiere of the reboot, I have not gotten sick of hearing that opening credits song. So, yeah.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Emily.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted for your podcasting pleasure. We thank you for downloading, scrolling, clicking, or whatever it is you do to find us on a regular basis. Your loyalty is much appreciated. I'm Jim Tarano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic from the end of the web to your screen.